I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and this is Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. A Swedish friend of mine once said to me, "Don't you find it odd how you Americans dedicate one day out of every year to clog your freeways and your airports just to get together and stop for a minute and be grateful for what you already have? Why do you need a day for that?" And I agree with him. It's strange that gratitude has a national holiday. And perhaps one of the reasons it's so important to us is that a growing number of Americans live considerable distances from their mothers and their fathers and their sisters and brothers. So it's an opportunity to reconnect with friends and family. And yet the holidays are complicated by the fact that family visits aren't always pleasant. It can bring out the worst in us. It can expose our flaws and push our limits. And it's not like you leave your problems behind you at the office or at home. They will definitely follow you wherever you go. But there are those rare instances in which the weights that we carry can be healed by looking back, by taking a seat beside the family tree. So today on Arrivals, a story that we're calling "This Moment is Worth It."
We've got the news covered tonight from every angle, from outside of Lehman Brothers, Merrill, and AIG to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange.
Plus, in the fall of 2008, I was highly aware of the fact that the housing crisis was turning into a financial crisis, partly because, like everybody, I paid attention to the news, but also because I worked in the news. I was working for Minnesota Public Radio at the time, and we were covering the financial crisis at the same time that it was happening. And so there would be conversations in the hallway about things that somebody had learned because they were interviewing somebody in New York City. And there was just this rising level of panic in the building, which then started to spill over into the business we were all in. And we started having meetings where they would tell us they were going to have to make hard choices, and then we would get emails saying that people were being laid off.
And that's a very typical concern that people have. Now you're getting these forced liquidations here. Well, I saw heavy put buying going on. We've got an options expiration going on this week, remember? So there's a lot of discussion about what's going to happen Thursday and Friday when we roll over into new contracts. Remember, there's a lot of cash on the sidelines.
And at the same time, my wife had recently gone back to work. She'd been staying home with our kids for 2 years. And so we suddenly had to start taking our kids to daycare. We had a 2- and a 4-year-old at the time. And so it became my job to get the kids ready in the morning and drop them off at daycare before I went to work. And it was a hard transition because my son in particular, for at least the first month of dropping him off at daycare, would cry every time I tried to get him in the car. I mean, he was just miserable about going to daycare. And so I was waking up every morning to, you know, my son being miserable and then driving to work where everybody was freaked out by the economy. What I remember about that fall was that as the days were getting shorter through the end of September and October, it started to feel as though the lack of light in the mornings was almost like a lack of oxygen. Like I would wake up in the morning and it was almost like I was short of breath. And I would get to work and I would feel short of breath for the rest of the day. And then the next day when it was even darker, it would feel like there was less oxygen. It was around that time that I also started to wake up at about 3 a.m. and not be able to get back to sleep. I remember, I think the first time it happened, my son woke me up because he's always been a terrible sleeper. And so I got out of bed and put him back to bed. And then when I came back to bed, I couldn't fall back to sleep. And then the next night, even though my son didn't wake me up, I woke up as if I had, you know, had that alarm now programmed into my brain. And so for the next several weeks, I was waking up every night at 3 a.m. and not able to get back to sleep. All of these things started to blend into each other. You know, the crisis in the financial markets and the crisis at work where people were being laid off, and this crisis of trying to get my kids ready every morning for daycare. And I remember one specific morning putting my daughter on my lap and looking at her tangled mass of hair, which I had to brush every morning before I dropped her off at daycare. And I remember looking at the tangles and just thinking, there is no way I'm going to be able to untangle this. Like, there's no way I'm going to get through the next 5 minutes of my life. I started to make mistakes at work. This was actually the first job that I'd had in a while where I was having to keep track of many different things. I was having to keep track of who we had booked for the show, when the interview was going to take place. I was doing research for the host. I was writing promos. I was sending those promos off to stations. I was fact-checking. I was proofreading. And keeping all these balls in the air when you're waking up every night at 3 a.m. and unable to get back to sleep was impossible. And so I started to drop some of those balls. And then my panic compounded because suddenly, whereas I had felt relatively safe from the economic crisis because I didn't, you know, have money invested, I didn't feel like it could touch me. But suddenly, it was like it was touching me indirectly by making me bad at my job. And I started to worry that if I make enough mistakes, I'm going to lose this job. And then I'm going to be out in that cold world that everybody is talking about on the radio, and how scary it is that we might be going into the next, you know, Great Depression or something. So it was around that time that I Googled the word depression, because I thought maybe some of this isn't my life. Maybe some of this is what's happening in my brain. I remember those mornings when I would take my kids to daycare. I remember stepping outside and thinking, fall is one of the most beautiful times of the year. I should look at it and see how beautiful it is. And I would look at it, and I would see red trees and yellow trees, and the sun was coming up, and it should have been beautiful, but it just felt like it was drained of any reality somehow. Like, it felt two-dimensional. It felt sort of fake, like I was looking at a computer screen. And I remember driving in my car and putting on music, songs that I liked. And I remember thinking, like, listen to this song. This song will make you feel better. And it was like the song was... It felt like the song was under glass. And I could hear it under the glass, but it was like it wasn't fully getting to me. During this period, my wife and I were not really talking at all. She was leaving for work at quarter to seven. Yeah, she was leaving at work at quarter to seven. I was getting the kids off to daycare. I would go to my office. until about 4. Then I would come home, pick the kids up from daycare, come back to the house. We would have dinner with the kids. And having dinner with a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old is not conducive to conversation. And then we would get the kids to bed by about 7. And then I would just lie down and try to sleep. Because if I was waking up at 3 a.m. every night, I needed to go to bed earlier. And so I just kept going to bed earlier and earlier until I was going to bed as soon as I put my kids to bed. And even though I was lying down, I wasn't usually falling asleep. I would often lie there for, you know, a couple hours before I actually fell asleep. And then I'd be awake again a few hours after that. So I go to see the doctor, and she gives me this survey, and it's just obvious that I have depression with some anxiety as a part of that. And she's like, you know, you really should get on this medication. And at the time I was like, I don't know if I want to take medication. Like, medication seems so crazy. Like, I'm going to be putting these chemicals in my brain. And she's like, this is normal. Like, people take medication, it's not that big of a deal. And what we wound up deciding was that I would start out on a very low dose of this medication. And I actually remember going and picking it up at the pharmacy and thinking that it was sort of like I was getting new software for my computer, and I was gonna like install that software when I got home and then see how my computer ran differently. And it started to seem kind of interesting to me. And taking that medication did make me feel a little better. I think if I had to describe what the difference was, it was that before I got on the medication, I had started thinking almost all the time about everything that might go wrong, or every little mistake that I had made, or every little thing, every little piece of evidence that I was not doing a good job in my at my workplace or in my life at home. Like, I would just obsessively think about all the things that I was doing wrong. And on top of that were all of these physical effects of, you know, feeling like kind of scraped out on the inside, like I don't know, the way that you feel when you've had too much coffee. Like I felt that physical symptom as well. And when I got on the medication, essentially what happened was the thoughts got turned down. The volume of those thoughts got turned down. But I still felt sort of physically ill, like the world still felt like a TV that was on a little too bright, like it was burning my eyes a little bit. And I still felt like I wasn't able to focus at my job very well. But I just... it was like I could function. It's like it made me functional, but not anywhere close to happy. And then it was November, and Thanksgiving was coming. And the plan that year was for my wife and my kids and I to drive from St. Paul, Minnesota, where we lived, to Lafayette, Indiana, which is where my grandmother and my aunt live and where my mother grew up. So my wife and I started to talk about whether we were actually going to do this. Were we actually going to drive the, you know, 12-hour drive to see my grandma and my aunt and my mother and my father for Thanksgiving in the midst of this mental health situation? And my feeling was, yes, we are going to do it, because I do what my mom asks me to do. She knows how to make me feel tremendously guilty if she's not happy with my decision, and I don't like to feel guilty. But I also don't get to see my grandmother very often, and she's one of my favorite people in the world. So yes, we are going to drive from St. Paul to Lafayette, Indiana, even though I'm sort of crazy at the moment and sort of mentally ill. So, the week leading up to that was it was almost like there was this, I don't know what the term is. It was like there was a like biblical signs that maybe this was a bad idea. So the first sign was that my son broke out in hives for no apparent reason. He just broke out in hives like a day before we were supposed to go. And then that same day, our washing machine broke. So all the laundry that we were trying to do in preparation for the trip, I suddenly had to do that laundry at a laundromat. And then my brakes started squeaking. And so I had to rush the car over to the Tires Plus that could check my brakes. And it was like there were all these signs. And I felt like with each new one, my wife would give me this look like, see, we should not do this. We should not go. And I was like, no, we should go. We should go. We have to go. And so we woke up on Wednesday morning before Thanksgiving, super early. And we got in the car to drive to Lafayette. And when you drive from St. Paul, Minnesota to Lafayette, Indiana, you have to go through Chicago or near Chicago. And we had gotten advice about how to get there. And the advice was bad. We got stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic around, I don't know, maybe noon or 1 p.m. And we were stuck in traffic near Chicago for at least 2 or 3 hours. And when you're stuck in traffic, it's bad enough. But when you've got a 2- and a 4-year-old in the back seat, it's even worse. And I just remember going through that experience, just sort of like gripping the steering wheel because I was driving and just being like, I'm going to get through this. We're going to get through this traffic and we're going to get there and everything's going to be okay. And we eventually got through the traffic. By then, I think it was getting dark. The sun was going down. And, you know, when you drive from Chicago into Indiana, it's just this like industrial wasteland all around you, like all these I don't know, like parking lots full of trucks and big factory machinery and smokestacks. And there's this road that I think it's the most heavily traveled road in the United States for shipping containers. There's all these trucks driving past you and you feel like you're surrounded by these driving walls. It's like there's... you can barely see the sky. You can't see in front of you. You're just surrounded by these enormous vehicles. But you finally get through that, and then you're in this fairly beautiful, actually, farm country in Indiana. And, you know, there's, like, big antennas off in the distance and these red lights blinking on and off. And it feels like, oh, like, we're going to make it. Like, it's going to be okay. We're going to get there, and it's going to be okay. It's funny to think back on that drive because I'm sure there were moments during the drive when my children slept and my wife and I would have been able to have a conversation. But I have no memory of any conversations we had. I feel like I was just focused on getting us there and she was sort of like somebody who's in a car feeling like maybe this situation is a little bit dangerous and just kind of hoping she gets through it. I don't know. I don't know what she was thinking. But what I also don't remember is at what point it started to occur to me that we were driving back to the hometown of my mother, whose twin brother had committed suicide when he was about the same age I was then. I was just 2 years old at the time, so I didn't even know him. But he was this character that loomed large in my mother's stories about him. He'd always been kind of like sort of a rebel. He had fought a lot with his dad. He went off and joined the army before the Vietnam War got really going, and then was there for about 6 years, and then came home from the war and turned into, you know, somewhat of a hippie, I guess, and dated a woman, and then they broke up. And he came home to his parents' house in Lafayette, Indiana, after that breakup to, you know, have a place to live. And while he was staying with them, they had a lake house, and he went up to the lake house and hanged himself. It started to occur to me at some point on that trip down that I was going back to the town where all that had happened, and that this depression that had seemed so odd to me suddenly seemed like, well, of course I have depression. Like, of course I have a genetic predisposition to this. This clearly runs in my family. So we get there, and, you know, it's great. It's great to see my parents. It's great to see my aunt and my grandmother that night. But then the next day, the little irritations start to pile up. I mean, it's always hard to travel with your children when they're that little, but especially my son. We didn't realize at the time, but he had all these terrible allergies, and so he was always having these weird reactions to wherever he stayed and seeming to get sick. And so I'm sure that was going on at the time. And then we went to have Thanksgiving dinner. Instead of having it at my aunt's house, my grandmother really wanted us to have it at her nursing home, which was this huge banquet. And they had this huge banquet hall. But when we got there, it turned out we were going to have to wait in line for about an hour before we could get in and eat. And I'm here with my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old. And it's just like my sensitivity to irritation in my current mental health was not good. And so I remember I couldn't wait in line. I had to just walk around the building in order to keep myself calmed down, because it was so frustrating to me. And it just seemed like we'd made such a terrible decision by going to this banquet hall. It's interesting to think about the fact that the whole purpose, supposed purpose of Thanksgiving, you know, it's the only holiday where we don't give each other gifts. It's just about people coming together. And that was theoretically what we were all doing there. And yet the entire time that I was there, all I could think about was myself. And we finally got in there and we ate, and I was probably a total asshole about the whole situation. When I think about what I must have looked like from the point of view of the other people in that situation, I'm sure I just seemed like a total prick, you know, being super annoyed. Just live with it, you know? I assume a lot of people have little irritations when they're visiting family. You know, you spend a day with them and it's fun, and then you start to remember all the little things that get under your skin. And the next day was when that really came to fruition, because my mother had planned all of these things that she wanted to take my kids to. She wanted to take them to see my grandmother's apartment at the nursing home, and she wanted to take them to this children's museum, and she wanted to take them to the public library to see this art installation. And we got to my grandma's apartment that morning, and the kids were already fussy. And then we were trying to figure out when we were going to eat lunch and where we were going to eat lunch. And my son, it was an incredibly picky eater, which turned out was because of his allergies. And then were we going to have time to go to the museum? And it just all started to feel like too much. We're trying to do too much. My kids are too fussy. I can't handle this situation. This is all too much. And so my mom said, well, let's just go to the library and see this art installation. And I didn't even want to do that. But the only reason that I said yes was that the art installation at the public library was actually donated by my mom's parents in memory of my mom's brother, Bob. And so, again, just like I felt like I had to come down to Lafayette for Thanksgiving, I felt like I had to go to this library to see this art installation, which was turning into some sort of like memorial moment for my mom's brother. The art installation was these things hung from the ceiling, a series of long sculptures which combine elements of sort of organic material like wood with more sort of mechanical material like pieces of metal, things that are brightly colored and then things that are, you know, just kind of dark. They all resemble sort of like aquatic animals, but like abstract shapes of aquatic animals. And the way this thing worked was that you can turn it on and they move. And so we all come in to the library, into this reading area. You know, we sit down on the beanbags and the floor and look up at the ceiling, and they flip the switch. And we all just sat there watching these creatures just go up and down like they were, you know, swimming or floating in water. I don't think I actually did think that much about my mom's brother while I was standing there looking at that art sculpture. I think I was thinking entirely about myself, which feels shameful to say, because I feel like in that moment, like, the sculpture is dedicated to him. It was donated for him, and his story does touch on my story. But I think what I was really thinking in that moment was, oh, you know, like, there was all this irritation and all this frustration starting from the very beginning of this journey for Thanksgiving. And I've been miserable this whole time. But this moment is worth it. And what I remember about that moment was that it just felt like I could breathe.
Special thanks to Robert McGinley Myers for sharing his story. Robert hosts an incredible story-driven podcast called Anxious Machine, about all those things that people make and how those things transform their lives. Anxious Machine and Arrivals are both founding members of The Herd, an audio collective featuring six independent producers from across North America. We've banded together to share resources, to promote one another's work, and sometimes to collaborate. You can listen to Arrivals, Anxious Machine, and all the other Herd shows on our website, theherdradio.com. That's the H-E-A-R-D radio.com. This episode of Arrivals was sound designed, produced, and recorded in between pillows and underneath a blanket in the lovely East Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, by me, Jonathan Hirsch, with help from Nora Lind and Emma Jacobs. We would love to hear from you, our listeners. Arrivals is now entering its third season of shows. And if you or someone you know has a story of migration, transformation, or change that needs to be heard, email us your stories to arrivalsshow@gmail.com. You can also contact us by visiting our website, arrvls.com. We release a microcast called En Route, which features outtakes, extended interviews, and other ephemera from the Arrivals podcast, which you can find there as well. And lastly, the biggest credit goes to you, our listeners, for supporting the show, for continuing to tune in. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.